a number of us have raised questions about whether we should be looking at other ways of setting global goals that would be more directly related to how humans are affecting the climate and to the policies that humans are adopting to try and control their emissions. And that would make it easier to measure actual progress. Because right now, it's actually very hard to take the pulse of whether we're doing well or poorly with climate policy, because our major indicator is a globally average indicator that's responsive to so many different factors.
We have been talking with Dr. David G. Victor, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation at UC San Diego. David is co-author of the paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. You can find links to follow up on all of this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Some of this discussion and Hansen's recent work was stimulated by observation from a non-scientist, Leon Simons, in the Netherlands. Let's hear it from Simons on Radio EcoShock, January 11th, 2023.
This is Radio EcoShock.
You may know James Hansen as a leading climate scientist from NASA, the man who warned Congress about global warming in 1988. Hansen is out with a new bombshell paper called Global Warming in the Pipeline. It is not yet peer-reviewed, but it's out there on the net for comment. The paper is huge. Hansen says we have already reached a doubling point of greenhouse gas emissions when we count the other global warming gases like methane, nitrous oxide, and a bunch of halogens. The authors also claim mainstream science has underestimated the power of what will happen now that the Earth is so far out of energy balance. This is disputed by other scientists. Finally, Hansen says, as he has for a decade, that when you add this up, sea level rise will be much higher than we have been told. We're going to start with just one of the most concrete and provable instances of hidden warming that is being revealed by a change in the atmosphere. This is the story of how clouds of pollution that cooled the sea and the land are disappearing, letting in the full power of the sun. Among the authors, we can find Leon Simons. Leon is not officially a climate scientist, and yet James Hansen credits Leon's contribution to this paper. Simons nailed a crucial change in ship emissions and cloud formation. Leon is an independent climate policy analyst and a Netherlands board member of the Club of Rome. From the Netherlands, Leon Simons, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
How could global shipping modify global heating?
Yeah, so there's two things to consider. Of course, there's the greenhouse gas emissions of global shipping. Many people will know about that. When the ships burn fuel, that's oil from refineries, which is more or less the end product. So the good stuff, let's say, goes to cars and to airplanes. What's left is the more sticky stuff, which needs to be heated to be able to be burned in these chambers. It's more like in between oil and coal, let's say, so it's very thick. And that contains, of course, carbohydrates, and carbohydrates contain the energy. And if these carbohydrates are burned, that releases CO2. So that's what most people will know about energy use, is the CO2 emissions associated with that energy use. But these fuels, which are taken from the ground, also contain sulfur. Most people know that if a volcano erupts, that a lot of sulfur is emitted into the atmosphere. If you are near a volcano, you will smell the sulfur. Fossil fuels taken from the ground contain sulfur. And the oil that is burned by ships had until recently a very high sulfur content, that was 3.5%. And sulfur, when it's burned, it will go into the atmosphere and it will become very small particles. And these very small particles, they are very light, bright, and they will reflect sunlight. But these particles also act as what is called condensation nuclei, which means that water droplets in the atmosphere, water vapor, will condensate against this particle of sulfur, which makes it create clouds. But because these particles are very small, the sulfur particles are very small, very large and bright clouds will be formed. And when this is done over the oceans, the dark ocean will be covered by a large layer of cloud, which reflects sunlight. And with a lot of emissions over the oceans, by about 50,000 ships, a over the past decades that resulted in a cooling of the oceans. And with the reduction of sulfur fuel content as litigated by the International Maritime Organization, the concentration of sulfur in the fuel reduced from 3.5% to 0.5%, and that results in a very significant reduction, of course, in emissions over the oceans, which is then resulting in a reduction of cloud formation, which reduces sunlight that is reflected back to space, and then accordingly there will be more heat absorbed by the ocean. And now from data from NASA, we can see that there's less sunlight reflected back to space, especially over regions of heavy shipping, which is, for example, between North America and Europe and North America and China. We see a very clear signal that there is less sunlight being reflected back to space, which is in line with the limited modeling studies that have been done, which predicted that especially in these regions there will be additional warming from reduction of sulfur emissions from shipping.
Did you establish the role of ship pollution relative to other sources of human-made aerosols?
Yes, there is indeed emission reductions from sulfur from in the United States, from cars, and but also especially with the reduction in coal use. When fracking started in the past decades, there was a significant switch to the burning of gas instead of coal, which reduced emissions of sulfur from the United States in about 12 years with 70%, and it was the same happened in China, as you mentioned, where a lot of coal plants either installed these scrubbers where they take sulfur from the emissions, or they close the dirty plants and build new ones which should have these scrubbers. So indeed there's a lot of policy happening globally which is reducing sulfur emissions. But we do see, especially in the regions where the ships sail, we see that especially there is a very significant increase in absorbed solar radiation. And that is a relatively pristine environment because there's, of course, that there are no other industries and there's potentially some wind bringing pollution from other regions, but the atmospheric lifetime of these particles is about 10 days. Therefore, you expect the most effect over the oceans and the change of the oceans coming from ships. Of course, we have still only about 2 years of data, starting in January 1st, 2020, and the most significant change in litigation was coming into effect. It's possible that it's variability or it's a different source, but the signal is really very strong. It's about 3.5 watts per square meter of increased solar radiation happening over the North Pacific, the North Atlantic, and the United States, this area combined, and that's a significant part of the globe, and especially by looking at such a large area, that helps to reduce the uncertainty of variability.
And one of the biggest concerns about geoengineering, like injection of sulfates into the upper atmosphere to cool the planet, is what if it stops for any reason, from economic breakdown to war or political change? Now, some people hear the term termination shock and they think of mass extinction. You led a 2021 paper about termination shock. What do you mean by that term?
Termination shock is a term that's often used when talking about geoengineering, where the climate is cooled down by especially putting sulfur into the stratosphere, and then that causes cooling. But if you stop, then stopping that could result in rapid warming. But termination shock is also the effect of terminating other emissions. And the shock describes the rapid warming. The rapid warming is described as a minimum of about 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years.
That is distributed globally, so it could be a lot more than that when it arrives on land, for example, in a heat wave or something like that.
Yeah, so this 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years, that's a minimum to describe it as a termination shock. And we don't know if there will be a termination shock. That depends on the effect which it will have on the climate, which again, are still uncertain, but the first signs is that it might be, the effect might be stronger than most even climate scientists thought. And indeed, the local, the regional effects will be stronger. So there will be more warming in areas where these emissions have been reduced, because that's also the areas where initially there was cooling. For example, in Europe, in the 1980s, there was a very high amount of sulfur emissions from coal burning. And then for health reasons and to reduce acid rain, there were scrubbers installed at these coal-fired power plants. And then in the past decades, we've seen a very rapid increase in warming. And Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius over the past 40 years. So since 1980 or 1990, Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius. And that increase in the rate of warming was caused by reduced sulfur emissions, and which caused less clouds and more sunshine and more warming. If you want to reduce that effect by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you would have to stop emitting any greenhouse gases for 10 years. If it results in temperatures which we have never seen ever in our lifetimes, we should know about that and we should be able to prepare for that. That there is an iceberg approaching, so we should be preparing, we should be getting the lifeboats ready, so to say.
Leon Simons is the independent climate analyst based in the Netherlands. He is co-author of the new paper, Global Warming and the Pipeline.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Did Leon Simons attribute too much to ship emissions as the cause of the excess warming since 2020? A number of leading scientists think larger natural systems are likely more important. But we hear about both in this sample from my interview with George Saloteotis. Satellites show more energy is staying on Earth instead of bouncing back into space. The sun did not change. So why were the last 2 years significantly hotter than any recorded before? For scientists, it became a race to find the cause. Now we have a confident answer based not on theories or models, but on raw observations. Blame the clouds. George Saloteotis is a research physical scientist at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He came through physics to meteorology and entered the early days of climate science. Well, recently he crunched 40 years of satellite records with his team, and they were analyzing the cloud cover on Earth. They found the world's storm zones are contracting. The land and sea may be getting less shade, leading to record heating. This is breaking knowledge we need. From New York, George Saloteotis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Does your research suggest changes in cloud cover warm the Earth more than human-made gases?
It's hard to say that it's more than greenhouse gases. Clouds are a feedback to the warming, meaning that greenhouse gases are a forcing. In other words, we emit more greenhouse gases and we force the atmosphere. Now, once the atmosphere is forced, it responds. And one of the responses is by making more or less clouds, or making more clouds of one kind and fewer clouds of another kind. So clouds are a response to the forcing. That's why we call them feedbacks. Now, how big or how strong is this cloud feedback is something that we haven't really confidently resolved yet. It may be that the cloud feedback in itself can be even bigger than the forcing at some points, but I cannot say at this point that we're confident that we know the value of the cloud feedback to the extent that we can judge whether it's larger or smaller than the forcing. Overall, it appears to be smaller than the forcing because clouds warm and cool the climate at the same time. They reflect sunlight and they cool the climate, but they also trap heat and they warm the climate. So when we add all the cloud effects together, it turns out that the feedback is relatively small, or at least our best estimate for the feedback. Again, we're not confident about this feedback number yet, so I cannot really give a definitive answer to that question.
Fair enough. Well, you obviously know former NASA scientist James Hansen. His team pointed to sulfur reductions in ship emissions as a probable cause of the recent spike in warming and the Earth energy imbalance. They found fewer clouds over shipping lanes in the Pacific. Is that enough to explain the extra energy? Are these the cloud changes that you covered in your two recent papers?
Well, the changes in shipping emissions is definitely one of the reasons for the recent increases in the amount of absorbed solar radiation at the Earth's surface. However, the changes in shipping emission regulations were imposed basically from 2020 on, so the effects are over the last 4 or 5 years, the effects that we're seeing from those new regulations. I mean, there were some regulations starting in 2015, but we believe that the main regulations really that had a real effect are the ones that started in 2020. The changes that I am showing in the last two papers, basically the last 40 years, so this reduction in the world's storm cloud zones is something that we observe in satellite observations over the last 40 years. So whatever is happening with the shipping emissions is in addition to this background of changes that is in response to the reduction of this storm cloud zone. So the two are not the same thing. One is a smaller, probably smaller effect, but much longer term, much more longer term. The other is a much more recent effect and may well be more intense overall.
You know, clouds and cloud study are super complex. There were several times when I just had to sort of walk away from your paper and then come back to it because it requires a lot of learning just to get there. But why don't we break it down a little bit? We could start with the zones of the atmosphere where your group found significant cloud change. Closest to the equator, what is this intertropical convergence zone in the atmosphere? What goes on there?
The intertropical convergence zone is a zone that basically circles the globe near the equator. It's a zone of very thick rainy clouds. It's a very wet with thick raining clouds. It's called a convergence zone because at the surface there's a convergence of the surface winds that favors the lifting of the moisture from the surface and therefore favors the formation of the very thick storm clouds in that region. So the intertropical convergence zone is this zone where the atmosphere is converging at the surface, is lifting up the moisture, and is producing very thick, very reflective, and very hard-raining clouds.
And you found some changes in the clouds in this intertropical convergence zone, or we could call it ITCZ. Oh, tell us about that, please.
Yeah, what we find when we look at the satellite observations is a narrowing of this intertropical convergence zone. Basically, this zone is becoming more narrow. Now, we're not the first ones to find this narrowing of the ITCZ. There have been studies in the past, in the last 10 years, that have looked at precipitation rather than clouds, because you can also see this intertropical convergence zone in precipitation observations, since that's a very hard raining region. And they also found this narrowing of the intertropical convergence zone. Also, there have been modeling studies that find a similar narrowing of that zone with climate warming. So we have a reason to suspect that the narrowing of the zone is in response to climate warming.
From the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, we've been speaking with senior research scientist George Seliotis. And you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Ships are not the only factor in human pollution, of course. Large parts of North India have been covered for months by dense smog. It's industrial, it's from cars. It has been unsafe to breathe outside in the Indian capital of Delhi sometimes. A couple of decades ago, Ram Ramanathan of the Scripps Institute documented this long-lasting cloud of pollution, calling it the Asian Brown Cloud. A similar bank of persistent smog formed over China during its rapid industrialization. Both China and India burn a lot of coal, which releases sulfates that reflect sunlight well. India in particular has been artificially cooled by pollution. Strange to think, isn't it? Naturally, billions of people call for better air. Both governments are working to reduce pollution. China has been more successful so far, and part of that is their choice for renewable energy. About a quarter of all cars sold in China are electric right now, and heavy diesel trucks are next for conversion. As both China and India clean up the air, there will be less sunlight reflected back into space and less cloud cover for shade. We will all heat up even more. Cleaning up deadly air pollution does not add to global warming. It reveals the true power of the warming gases we have already released. Our guest Yangyang Xu gave us a clear explanation of this double-edged sword on Radio EcoShock. The smog of rapid industrialization is thick, but Chinese authorities are working overtime to clear the air. But will air pollution get better or worse in a hotter world? Could cleaner air actually heat the planet? It's difficult to get the latest on the situation in China, but we have reached one of the best young scientists working on it. Dr. Yangyang Xu was educated in Beijing. He came to America to study with the legendary Ram Ramanathan at the Scripps Institution in San Diego. Now Yangyang is an assistant professor at Texas A&M University. He has already published 30 papers, with more in the works. Now, in a series of papers, you and your colleagues have investigated the behavior of air pollution in a warming world, and some of what you found is not what I expected. Could you describe those relationships between a hotter planet and the smog that we produce?
Yeah, there are two issues here, which is wrapped into the problem of the interaction of global warming and air pollution. By interaction, I mean air pollution can lead to less or more global warming. And the second half of this problem is global warming can also intensify or reduce air pollution. So let me explain the first part. We have all known the dominant cause of the global warming is from greenhouse gas emissions. But at the same time, those chimneys producing greenhouse gas are also emitting air pollution, such as particles. And most of the particles are reflecting solar radiation back to the space and therefore cooling the planet. So those are exactly offsetting the global warming effect. But of course, overall, global greenhouse gas warming is larger. That's why we have observed long-term warming trend in the past century. But the problem is, we could have experienced much more warming if we have not produced air pollution problem along the way, which means part of the global warming has been temporarily masked by air pollution from certain countries. But looking into the future, that trend will be well reversed due to the issues you have touched on, the health concerns, the visibility concerns in those regions, and the countries are taking fast actions to solve those issues. So if the air pollution problem will be quickly resolved in the next 20 or 30 years, that will contribute to a net warming instead of a cooling in the past. And that net warming will add on to any additional greenhouse gas warming. So that will bring us a much difficult problem to deal with in terms of adapting to climate change problem at the local scales. So that's the first part. I can explain more on the second part, but if you have question about the first half, I can further elaborate.
No, I think that we have talked about that on the program, how global dimming, as it were, can cool the planet, and we could be in trouble if we actually clean up all the air. We could go, I've heard figures from half a degree to 0.7 degrees warmer if the air was actually clean, and we'll talk more about that as we go along, but I am interested in the second part. For example, in January 2019, you co-authored a paper predicting worse pollution for East China due to increased greenhouse gases. So I'm left with the question, how can haze get worse even as the government tries to clean the air up?
Yes, let me explain on that. This is a trickier question, actually a very concerning one, in my personal opinion, which is global warming can actually make air pollution issues worse by itself. So we all know the air pollution issue is coming from large emission, dirty emission, but also is governed by meteorological conditions. Certain meteorological conditions can keep the particle emission longer in the atmosphere and make the concentration higher, which is affecting human health. But certain weather conditions, such as heavy rainfall or stronger wind, those can help remove the air pollution or dispersing air pollution to a different region to help the local air pollution problem. What we have been studying using global climate model is the future global warming, mostly coming from greenhouse gas, will actually make the meteorological condition worse to remove air pollution from the atmosphere. This meteorological factor is working against local action to cut emission. I'm not saying the local emission is not working. I'm just saying the meteorological condition is doing the opposite to the emission cut, which actually means you need to cut more than you have planned to reach certain air quality goals than what you have expected, because global warming will not help you in this regard.
From Texas A&M University, we have been talking with Dr. Yang-Yang Xu. He is the lead author in the new paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think, as published in the journal Nature. He is an expert in the relationships between air pollution in China and climate change. Find links to the science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I think Yang-Yang has a powerful message. Cleaning up pollution is necessary. It can save millions of lives. But reducing air pollution during global warming means we need to do more to get less. It works, but not as fast as we might expect. I think this is true of the whole greenhouse gas overload. Already in serious impacts from heat to destabilized weather and fires, we need to slash carbon emissions much faster. We will get less relief than if we'd done it 10 or 20 years ago. The deeper we get into climate change, the harder it becomes to save what we can. But there is no other choice. Find links to all these interviews and supporting science in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for hanging in there.
This is Bird Note. The northern Perula is a tiny bird with a big personality. Weighing barely more than a nickel, these North American warblers spend their days in search of tasty insects high up in the forest canopy. The northern Perula has a bright yellow throat and white belly. Their upper parts are slate gray, except for an olive-green patch that sits between their wings like a backpack. Males also sport a handsome chestnut-colored breastband. To get a good look at this varicolored wonder, first try listening for their unmistakable vocal feats. Like this upward trill, ending with a punchy note, a bit like pulling a zipper. Or a repeating series of boisterous, buzzy phrases. During the breeding season, males belt out these songs to find a mate and defend territory in the forests of the eastern U.S. and Canada. Meanwhile, females build small nests by hollowing out clumps of moss and lichen that hang up to 100 feet above the ground. After raising their young, northern Perulas head south to Mexico and the Caribbean for the winter, where they'll give their voices a bit of a rest till it's time to sing again in spring. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Today's show is sponsored by Gary and Liz Kennedy Ketchison, who are grateful to Bird Note for introducing us to wonderful stories about birds from around the world, like the beautiful northern Perula.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
CJSF